The Third Eye by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, read to you by Blue Friend. Chapter 9. At the Wild Rose Fence. The next morning we made our leisurely preparations to return to Chakpori. For us, the Patala visit was quite a holiday. Before leaving, I rushed up to the roof to have a last look at the countryside through the telescope. On a roof of the Chakpori, a small acolyte was lying on his back reading, and occasionally tossing small pebbles onto the bald heads of monks in the courtyard. Through the glass, I could see the impish grin on his face as he ducked back out of sight of the puzzled monks below. It made me acutely uncomfortable to realize that the Dalai Lama had no doubt watched me do similar tricks. In future, I resolved, I would confine my efforts to the side of the buildings hidden from the Patala. But it was time to leave, time to say our thanks to those monks who had worked to make our short stay so pleasant, time to be particularly nice to the Dalai Lama's personal steward. He had charge of the foods from India. I must have pleased him because he made me a farewell gift, which I was not slow to eat. Then, fortified, we started down the steps of our way back to the Iron Mountain. As we reached halfway, we became aware of shouts and calls, and passing monks pointed back behind us. We stopped, and a breathless monk rushed down and gasped out a message to the Lama Mingyar Dandap. My guide halted. "Wait here for me, Lobsang. I shall not be very long." With that, he turned and walked up the steps again. I idled around, admiring the view and looking at my former home. Thinking of it, I turned and almost fell over backwards as I saw my father riding towards me. As I looked at him, he looked at me, and his lower jaw dropped slightly as he recognized me. Then, to my unutterable pain, he ignored me and rode on. I looked at his retreating back and called, "Father!" He took no notice whatsoever, but rode stolidly on. My eyes felt hot, and I began to tremble, and I thought that I was going to disgrace myself in public on the steps of the Patala, of all places. With more self-control than I thought I possessed, I straightened my back and gazed out over Lhasa. After about half an hour, the Lama Mingyar Dandap came riding down the steps and leading another horse. "Get on, Lobsang. We have to get to Sera in a hurry. One of the abbots there has had a bad accident." I saw that there was a case tied to each saddle and guessed that it was my guide's equipment. Along the Lingkor Road, we galloped past my former home, scattering pilgrims and beggars alike. It did not take us long to reach Sera Lamasery, where monks were waiting for us. We jumped off the horses, each carrying a case, and an abbot led us to where an old man lay on his back. His face was the color of lead, and the life force seemed to be flickering almost to a halt. The Lama Mingyar Dandap called for boiling water, which was ready, and into it he dropped certain herbs. While I was stirring this, the Lama examined the old man, who had a fractured skull as a result of falling. A piece of bone was depressed and was exerting pressure on the brain. When the liquid was cool enough, we mopped the old man's head with it, and my guide cleaned his hands with some of it. Taking a sharp knife from his case, he quickly made a U-shaped cut through the flesh, right through to the bone. There was little bleeding. The herbs prevented it. More herbal lotion was mopped on, and the flap of flesh was turned back and cleared away from the bone. Very, very gently, the Lama Mingyar Dondup examined the area and found where the skull bone had been crushed in and was hanging below the normal level of the skull. He had put a lot of instruments into a bowl of disinfecting lotion before commencing. Now he took from the bowl two silver rods, flattened at one end, and with serrations in the flat part. With extreme care, he inserted the thinnest edge into the widest fracture of the bone, and held it rigidly while he took a firmer grip of the bone with the other rod. Gently, very gently, he prised up the flap of the bone so that it was just above the normal level. He wedged it there with one rod and said, "Now pass the bowl, Lobsang." I held it so that he could take what he wanted, and he took a small spike of silver, just a minute triangular wedge. This he pressed into the crack between the normal skull bone and the fractured edge, which was now slightly above the level. Slowly he pressed the bone a little. It moved slightly, and he pressed just a little more. The level was now normal. "It will knit together, and the silver, being an inert metal, will cause no trouble." He mopped the area with more herbal lotion and carefully put back the flap of flesh which had been attached by one side. With boiled hair from a horse's tail, he stitched the flap and covered the site of the operation with an herbal paste tied in place with boiled cloth. The old abbot's life force had been growing stronger since the pressure was relieved from his brain. We propped him up with cushions so that he was in a semi-sitting position. I cleaned the instruments in fresh boiling lotion, dried them on boiled cloth, and packed everything carefully back into the two cases. As I was cleaning my hands after, the old man's eyes flickered open, and he gave a weak smile as he saw the Lama Mingyar Dondup bending over him. "I knew that only you could save me. That is why I sent the mind message to the peak. My task is not yet finished, and I am not ready to leave the body." My guide looked at him carefully and replied, "You will recover from this. A few days of discomfort, a headache or two, and when that has gone, you can go about your work. For a few days you must have someone with you when you sleep, so that you do not lie flat. After 3 or 4 days, you will have no cause for worry." I had gone to the window and was looking out. It was quite interesting to see conditions in another lamasery. The Lama Mingyar Dondup came to me and said, "You did well then, Lobsang. We shall make a team. Now I want to show you around this community. It is very different from ours." We left the old abbot in the care of a lama and went out into the corridor. The place was not so clean as at Jakpuri, nor did there seem to be any strict discipline. Monks seemed to come and go as they pleased. The temples were uncared for compared to ours, and even the incense was more bitter. Gangs of boys were playing in the courtyard. At Chakpori, they would have been hard at work. The prayer wheels were for the most part unturned. Here and there an aged monk sat and twirled the wheels, but there was none of the order, cleanliness, and discipline which I had come to take as average. My guide said, "Well, Lobsang, would you like to stay here and have their easy life?" "No, I would not. I think there are a lot of savages here," I said. He laughed. 7,000 of them. It is always the noisy few who bring the silent majority into disrepute. "That may be fine," I replied, "but although they call this the Rose Fence, that is not what I would call it." He looked at me with a smile. "I believe you would take on the job of bringing discipline to this lot single-handed." It was a fact that our lamasery had the strictest discipline of any. Most of the others were very lax indeed, and when the monks there wanted to laze, well, they just lazed, and nothing was said about it. Sarah, or the Wild Rose Fence, as it is really called, is 3 miles from the Patala and is one of the lamasaries known as the Three Seats. Drepung is the largest of the three, with not less than 10,000 monks. Sarah comes next in importance, with about 7,500 monks, while Ganden is the least important, with a mere 6,000. Each is like a complete town, with streets, colleges, temples, and all the usual buildings that go to make up a township. The streets were patrolled by the men of Cam. Now, no doubt, they are patrolled by communist soldiers. Chakpori was a small community, but an important one. As the temple of medicine, it was then the seat of medical learning, and was well represented in the council chamber of the government. At Chakpori, we were taught what I shall term judo. That is the nearest English word I can find. The Tibetan description of Sung through Kiam Pa Tu De Pola Le La Po cannot be translated, nor can our technical word of Amri. Judo is a very elementary form of our system. Not all lamasaries had this training, but we at Chakpori were taught it to give us self-control, to enable us to deprive others of consciousness for medical purposes, and to enable us to travel safely in rougher parts of the country. As medical lamas, we traveled extensively. Old Tzu had been a teacher of the art, perhaps the best exponent of it in Tibet, and he taught me all he knew for his own satisfaction in doing a job well. Most men and boys knew the elementary holds and throws, but I knew them when I was 4 years of age. This art, we believe, should be used for self-defense and self-control, and not after the manner of a prize fighter. We are of the opinion that the strongest man can afford to be gentle, while the weak and unsure brag and boast. Our judo was used to deprive a person of consciousness when, for instance, setting bones, or extracting teeth. There is no pain with it and no risk. A person can be made unconscious before he is aware of its onset, and he can be restored to full consciousness hours or seconds later without ill effect. Curiously enough, a person made unconscious while speaking will complete the sentence upon awakening. Because of the obvious dangers of this higher system, this and instant hypnotism were taught only to those who could pass most stringent tests of character. And then, hypnotic blocks were imposed so that one should not abuse the powers conferred. In Tibet, a lamasery is not merely a place where men of religious inclination live, but a self-contained town with all the usual facilities and amenities. We had our theaters in which to see religious and traditional plays. Musicians were ever ready to entertain us and prove that in no other community were there such good players. Those monks who had money were able to buy food, clothing, luxuries, and books in the shops. Those who desired to save deposited their cash in the lamastic equivalent of a bank. All communities in any part of the world have their offenders against the rules. Ours were arrested by monk police and taken off to a court where they were given a fair trial. If found guilty, they had to serve their sentence in the lamastic prison. Schools of various types catered for all grades of mentality. Bright boys were helped to make their way, but in all lamasaries other than Chakpori, the slothful person was permitted to sleep or dream his life away. Our idea was, one cannot influence the life of another, so let him catch up in his next incarnation. At Chakpori, matters were different, and if one did not make progress, one was compelled to leave and seek sanctuary elsewhere, where the discipline was not so strict. Our sick monks were well treated. We had a hospital in the lamasaries, and the indisposed were treated by monks who were trained in medicine and elemental surgery. The more severe cases were treated by specialists, such as the Lama Mingyar Dondap. Quite often since leaving Tibet, I have had to laugh at the Western stories about Tibetans thinking that a man's heart is on the left side and a woman's is on the right. We saw enough dead bodies cut open to know the truth. I have also been much amused about the filthy Tibetans riddled with VD. The writers of such statements apparently have never been in those convenient places in England and America where the local citizenry are offered free and confidential treatment. We are filthy. Some of our women, for instance, put stuff on the face and have to mark the position of the lips so that one cannot miss. Most times they put stuff on their hair to make it shine or to alter the color. They even pluck eyebrows and color nails, sure signs that Tibetan women are filthy and depraved. But to return to our lamastic community, often there were visitors. They might be traders or monks. They were given accommodation in the lamastic hotel. They also paid for such accommodation. Not all monks were celibate. Some thought that single blessedness did not induce the right frame of mind for contemplation. Those were able to join a special sect of red hat monks who were permitted to marry. They were in the minority. The yellow hats, a celibate sect, were the ruling class in religious life. In married lamaseries, monks and nuns worked side by side in a well-ordered community, and most times the atmosphere there was not so rough as in a purely male community. Certain lamaseries had their own printing works so that they could print their own books. Usually they made their own paper. This latter was not a healthy occupation because one form of tree bark used in paper manufacture was highly poisonous. While this prevented any insect from attacking Tibetan paper, it also had a bad effect on the monks, and those who worked at this trade complained of severe headaches and worse. In Tibet, we did not use metal type. All our pages were drawn on wood of suitable character, and then everything except the drawn outlines was pared away, leaving the parts to be printed standing high above the rest of the board. Some of these boards were 3 feet wide by 18 inches deep, and the detail would be quite intricate. No board containing the slightest mistake was used. Tibetan pages are not like the pages of this book, which are longer than they are wide. We used wide and short pages, and they were always unbound. The various loose sheets were kept between carved wooden covers. In printing, the carved board of page contents was laid flat. One monk ran an ink roller over the whole surface, making sure of even distribution. Another monk took up a sheet of paper and quickly spread it on the board, while a third monk followed with a heavy roller to press the paper well down. A fourth monk lifted off the printed page and passed it to an apprentice who put it to one side. There were very few smudged sheets. These were never used for the book, but were kept for the apprentices to practice on. At Chakpori, we had carved wooden boards about 6 feet high and about 4 feet wide. These had carvings of the human figure and the various organs. From them were made wall charts, which we had to color. We had astrological charts as well. The charts on which we erected horoscopes were about 2 feet square. In effect, they were maps of the heavens at the time of a person's conception and birth. On the map blanks, we inserted the data which we found in the carefully prepared mathematical tables which we published. After looking over the Rose Fence Lamaseri, and in my case, comparing it unfavorably with ours, we returned to the room to see the old abbot again. During the 2 hours of our absence, he had improved very greatly and was now able to take much greater interest in things around him. In particular, he was able to pay attention to the Lama, Mingyar Dondup, to whom he seemed very attached. My guide said, "We must leave now, but here are some powdered herbs for you. I will give full instructions to your priest in charge as we leave." 3 little leather bags were taken from his case and handed over. three little bags which meant life instead of death to an aged man. In the entrance courtyard, we found a monk holding two deplorably frisky ponies. They had been fed and rested and were now very ready to gallop. I was not. Fortunately for me, the Lama Mingyar Dondup was quite content for us to amble along. The rose fence is about 3,700 yards from the nearest part of the Lingkor Road. I was not anxious to pass my old home. My guide evidently caught my thoughts, for he said, "We will cross the road to the street of shops. There is no hurry. Tomorrow is a new day which we have not yet seen." I was fascinated to look at the shops of the Chinese traders and to listen to their high, shrill voices as they bickered and chaffered at the prices. Just opposite their side of the street was a chortan, symbolizing immortality of the ego, and behind that loomed a gleaming temple to which the monks of nearby Shid Gompa were streaming. A few minutes' ride and we were in the lanes of cluttered houses which clustered as if for protection in the shadow of the Jokang. "Ah," I thought, "last time I was here I was a free man, not training to be a monk. Wish it was all a dream and that I could wake up." Down the road we ambled and turned right to the road which led over the turquoise bridge. The Lama, Mingyar Dondup, turned to me and said, "So, you still do not want to be a monk? It is quite a good life, you know. At the end of this week, the annual party are going to the hills to gather herbs. This time I do not want you to go. Instead, study with me so that you can take the examination for Trapa when you are 12. I have planned to take you on a very special expedition to the highlands to obtain some very rare herbs." Just then we had reached the end of the village of Sho and were approaching the Pargo Kaling, the western gate of the Valley of Lhasa. A beggar shrunk against the wall. "Oh, Reverend Holy Lama of Medicine, please do not cure me of my ills, or my living is gone." My guide looked sad as we rode through the chortan forming the gate. "So many of these beggars," Lobsang, "so unnecessary. It is they who give us a bad name abroad. In India and in China, where I went with the Precious One, people talked of the beggars of Lhasa, not realizing that some of them were rich. Well, well, perhaps after the fulfillment of the prophecy of the Year of the Iron Tiger, the beggars will be put to work." Note, that was 1950 when the communists invaded Tibet. "You and I will not be here to see it," Lobsang, "for you, foreign lands, for me, a return to the heavenly fields." It made me sad beyond measure to think that my beloved Lama would leave me, leave this life. Not then did I realize that life on earth was but an illusion, a testing place, a school, a knowledge of man's behavior to those beset by adversity was beyond me. Now it is not. Left, we turned into the Lingkor Road, past the Kundu Ling, and left again to our own road leading up to the Iron Mountain. I never tired of looking at the colored rock carving which made up one side of our mountain. The whole cliff face was covered with carvings and paintings of deities. But the day was far advanced, and we had no more time to spare. As we rode up, I thought of the herb gatherers. Every year, a party from the Chakpori went to the hills to gather herbs, dried them, and packed them into airtight bags. Here in the hills was one of the great storehouses of nature's remedies. Very few people, indeed, had ever been to the highlands, where there were things too strange to discuss. Yes, I decided, I could well forego a visit to the hills this year, and I would study hard so that I should be fit to accompany the expedition to the highlands when the Lama Mingyar Dondup thought fit. The astrologers had said that I would pass the examination at the first attempt, but I knew that I should have to study hard. I knew that the prediction meant, if I studied hard enough. My mental stage was at least equivalent to an 18-year-old boy. As always, I had mixed with people much older than I, and I had to fend for myself. End of chapter 9.